Windsor. We are CHRIS, the Connecticut Radio Information System.
Welcome to tonight's installment of the Regional Roundup on CHRIS. We invite you to join us for the next hour as we feature the top national, state, and local stories making headlines today.
From the CHRIS Broadcast Center in Windsor, here is tonight's Regional Roundup.
Today is Tuesday. It is March 19th. The year is 2024. I'm Jim McPherson, and reading the front pages of the Hartford Current and New York Times with me today is Kathy Danaher. Let's start by reviewing the photos on the front pages of these two newspapers from which we will be reading. On the front page of the Hartford Current, above the fold and across four of the five columns, we have a photo of a high-rise office tower with the walls of the upper floors covered in graffiti. The caption notes that it also shows traffic on Interstate 84 in Hartford, which is near to and within sight of this building at 25 Sigourney Street. "Not the image that we want" is the headline for the story that goes with this photo. And below that, we have a photo of UConn coach Dan Hurley, who appears to be yelling from the sidelines at a game. The caption tells us that he's reacting in the first half against St. John's during the semifinals of the Big East Tournament Friday at Madison Square Garden in New York City. On the front page of the New York Times, we have a large photo above the fold showing destruction of buildings and a body on the ground. Next to this person is a woman who is in clear emotional distress, and three others are in the background. A Palestinian woman with a boy wounded in a bombardment of Gaza City on Monday. "Israel raided the city's Al-Shifa hospital," reads the caption. Below that, there is a nighttime photo taken from outside an office building showing a portion of the exterior wall. Four floors are visible, with one of the 20 windows in the photo illuminated. Inside, there is a person in that office working. "Dark times for city budgets," is the caption, which goes on to note that cities reliant on taxes from commercial property face shortfalls in an urban doom loop. And to the right, we have a small photo of athletes from Dartmouth participating in a basketball game. Shown seated is Robert McRae III, whose team is unionized. "Are athletes truly employees? NCAA Ideal faces big tests," is the headline. Those are the photos on the front pages of today's two morning newspapers, at least the two from which we'll be reading. For the lead story in the New York Times, let's go to Kathy Danaher.
Court skeptical of state's claim on free speech. Justices wary of curbing federal bids to sway tech platforms. This by Adam Liptak. A majority of the Supreme Court seemed wary on Monday of a bid by two Republican-led states to limit the Biden administration's interactions with social media companies, with several justices questioning the state's legal theories and factual assertions. Most of the justices appeared convinced that government officials should be able to try to persuade private companies, whether news organizations or tech platforms, not to publish information, so long as the requests are not backed by coercive threats. The dispute was the latest in an extraordinary series of cases this term, requiring the justices to assess the meaning of free speech in the Internet era. Justices Brett M. Kavanaugh and Elena Kagan, both former White House lawyers, said interactions between administration officials and news outlets provided a valuable analogy. Efforts by officials to influence coverage are, they said, part of a valuable dialogue that is not prohibited by the First Amendment. Members of the court also raised questions about whether the plaintiffs, Missouri and Louisiana, along with five individuals, had suffered the kind of injury that gave them standing to sue. They also suggested that a broad injunction prohibiting contacts between many officials and the platforms was not a proper remedy in any event. Quote, "I don't see a single item in your briefs that would satisfy our normal tests," end quote, Justin Kagan told J. Benjamin Aguinaga, Louisiana Solicitor General. Justice Sonia Sotomayor accused the states of distorting the record of the case. Quote, I have such a problem with your brief, end quote, she told Mr. Aguinaga. You omit information that changes the context of some of your claims. You attribute things to people who it didn't happen to, end quote. Mr. Aguinaga apologized, quote, if any aspect of our brief was not as forthcoming as it should have been, end quote. The justices peppered Mr. Aguinaga with hypothetical questions about national security, the doxing of public officials, and contests that could endanger teenagers, all suggesting that there is a role for vigorous efforts by the government to combat harmful speech. Justice Samuel Alito Jr., the member of the court who appeared most sympathetic to the state's position, urged his colleagues to remain focused on the case before them. Quote, whatever coercion means, he said, whatever happened here is sufficient, end quote. The case arose from a barrage of communications from administration officials urging platforms to take down posts on topics like the coronavirus vaccines and claims of election fraud. Last year, a federal appeals court severely limited such interactions. The Supreme Court put that injunction on hold last year while it considered the administration's appeal. If it were to go into effect, said Brian H. Fletcher, a lawyer for the government, it would prohibit all sorts of speech, including public comments from the press, secretary, or other senior officials seeking to discourage posts harmful to children or conveying anti-Semitic or Islamophobic messages. He added that the social media companies had been moderating content on their platforms long before they were contacted by officials, had powerful business incentives to do so, and were following their own policies. The companies acted independently of the government, he said, and often rejected requests to take down postings. Quote, these were sophisticated parties, end quote. They routinely said no to the government. They weren't open about it. They didn't hesitate to do it. And when they said no to the government never engaged in any sort of retaliation, end quote. Justice Alito said the volume and intensity of the contacts were troubling, as was the suggestion in some of them that the government and the platform were partners in an effort to combat misinformation about the pandemic.
Now this headline from the World and Nation section of today's Hartford Current. Netanyahu okays Rafah talks with Biden team in states. This by Amr Madhani, Zeke Miller, and Julia Frankel of the Associated Press. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu agreed Monday to send a team of Israeli officials to Washington to discuss a prospective Rafah operation with Biden administration officials, White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said. The agreement to hold talks about Rafah came as President Joe Biden and Netanyahu spoke Monday, their first interaction in more than a month, as the divide has grown between allies over the food crisis in Gaza and Israel's conduct during the war, according to the White House. Sullivan said the talks will happen in the coming days and are expected to involve military intelligence and humanitarian experts. The White House has been skeptical of Netanyahu's plan to carry out an operation in the southern city of Rafah, where about 1.5 million displaced Palestinians are sheltering as Israel looks to eliminate Hamas after Hamas-led militants stormed into southern Israel in a surprise attack October 7th that killed about 1,200 people, mostly civilians. Around 250 people were taken hostage. Israel responded with one of the deadliest and most destructive military campaigns in recent history. The war has killed more than 31,000 Palestinians, according to Gaza's health ministry. Around 80% of Gaza's population of 2.3 million have fled their homes, and a quarter of the population faces starvation. Sullivan said Biden questioned the Israeli leader over a lack of a, quote, coherent and sustainable strategy to defeat Hamas, unquote. The Biden-Netanyahu call comes after Republicans in Washington and Israeli officials were quick to express outrage after Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer sharply criticized Netanyahu's handling of the war in Gaza and called for Israel to hold new elections. They accused the Democratic leader of breaking the unwritten rule against interfering in a close ally's electoral politics. Biden hasn't endorsed Schumer's call for an election, but said he thought he gave a good speech that reflected the concerns of many Americans. Netanyahu raised concerns about the calls by Schumer for new elections, Sullivan said. Biden administration officials have warned that they would not support an operation in Rafah without the Israelis presenting a credible plan to ensure the safety of innocent Palestinian civilians. Israel has yet to present such a plan, according to White House officials.
And from the New York Times, Trump unable to raise bond for fraud fine. This by Ben Protest, Maggie Haberman, and Kate Christabek. Donald J. Trump's lawyers disclosed on Monday that he had failed to secure a roughly $500 million bond in his civil fraud case in New York, raising the prospect that the state could seek to freeze some of his bank accounts and seize some of his marquee properties. The court filing, coming 1 week before the bond is due, suggested that the former president might soon face a financial crisis unless an appeals court comes to his rescue. Mr. Trump has asked the appeals court to pause the $454 million judgment that a New York judge imposed on Mr. Trump in the fraud case last month, or accept a bond of only $100 million. Otherwise, the New York Attorney General's office, which brought the case, might soon move to collect from Mr. Trump. Still, even if the higher court rejects his appeal, Mr. Trump is not entirely out of options. He might appeal to the state's highest court, quickly sell an asset, or seek help from a wealthy supporter. Mr. Trump's team has also left the door open to exploring a bankruptcy for corporate entities implicated in the case. According to people with knowledge of the discussions, that option, however, is politically fraught during a presidential race in which he is the presumptive Republican nominee, and for now, it appears unlikely. The judge in the civil fraud case, Arthur F. Engeron, levied the $454 million penalty and other punishments after concluding that Mr. Trump had fraudulently inflated his net worth to obtain favorable loans and other benefits. The case, brought by the New York Attorney General, Letitia James, has posed a grave financial threat to Mr. Trump. The former president has been unable to secure the full bond, his lawyer said in a court filing on Monday, calling it a, quote, practical impossibility, end quote, despite diligent efforts. Those efforts included approaching about 30 companies that provide appeal bonds, and yet, the lawyer said, he has encountered, quote, insurmountable difficulties, end quote. The company providing the bond would essentially promise to cover Mr. Trump's judgment if he lost an appeal and failed to pay. In exchange, he would pledge cash and other liquid assets as collateral, and he would pay the company a fee as high as $20 million.
Back now to the Hartford Current. Israelis raid hospital in Gaza, say Hamas regrouped at site. This article is by Yan Zhuang, Amira Haruda, and Hiba Yezbek of the New York Times. Israeli forces using tanks and bulldozers raided Shifa Hospital in the northern Gaza Strip on Monday in an operation they said was aimed at senior Hamas officials who had regrouped at the medical facility, setting off an hours-long battle that both sides said had resulted in casualties. The raid began before dawn, with the Israeli military's chief spokesperson, Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari, saying in a video statement that troops were operating in limited areas of the hospital complex. More than 12 hours later, Hamas military wing, the Qassam Brigades, said its forces were, quote, engaged in fierce clashes with enemy forces, unquote, near the hospital. The Israeli military said Hamas fighters had shot at its soldiers from within the complex, and soldiers had returned fire. The Gaza Health Ministry said Israeli forces launched missiles at the complex and fired into surgery rooms. Details of the fighting could not be independently verified. The Israeli military said it launched the raid based on new intelligence that Hamas officials were operating from the hospital, 4 months after Israeli forces stormed the complex and found a tunnel shaft they said supported their contention that the armed group had used it to conceal military operations. Since then, Israel has withdrawn many troops from northern Gaza and shifted the focus of its invasion to the south. During the operation Monday, Israel said its forces had killed 20 militants. Among those killed, it said, was a senior Hamas official it identified as Faik Mahoud, the head of operations for the internal security forces of the Hamas government in Gaza, who was, quote, armed and hiding in a compound, unquote, at the hospital. Hamas did not confirm his death or role in the organization. The Israeli military also said one of its soldiers had been killed in the fighting at Shifa. Hamas, in the statement from its armed wing, claimed that it had caused deaths and injuries to Israeli forces, but did not provide evidence. The hospital and the surrounding area house about 30,000 patients, medical workers, and displaced civilians, and a number of people were killed and wounded in the raid, the Gaza Health Ministry said. It added that a fire had broken out at the gate of the complex, which caused some people to suffocate and made it difficult to reach those who were injured.
And from the New York Times, little choice but for Putin to win huge, this by Paul Sonnet. The Kremlin stage managed Russia's presidential vote over the weekend to send a singular message at home and abroad, that President Vladimir V. Putin's support is overwhelming and unshakable, despite or even because of his war against Ukraine. From the moment the preliminary results first flashed across state television late Sunday, the authorities left no room for misinterpretation. Mr. Putin, they said, won more than 87% of the vote, his closest competitor just 4%. It had all the hallmarks of an authoritarian Potemkin plebiscite. The Kremlin may have felt more comfortable orchestrating such a large margin of victory because Mr. Putin's approval rating has climbed during the war in independent polls, owing to a rally around the flag effect and optimism about the Russian economy. The Levada Center, an independent pollster, reported last month that 86% of Russians approved of Mr. Putin, his highest rating in more than 7 years. But while the figures may suggest unabiding support for Mr. Putin and his agenda across Russia, the situation is more complex than the numbers convey. The leader of one opposition research group in Moscow has argued that backing for Mr. Putin is actually far more brittle than simple approval numbers suggest. Quote, "The numbers we get on polls from Russia don't mean what people think they mean," end quote, said Alexeya Minyalo, a Moscow-based opposition activist and co-founder of a research project called Chronicles, which has been polling Russians in recent months. Quote, "Because Russia is not an electoral democracy, but a wartime dictatorship," end quote. In a late survey, Chronicles asked one group of Russian respondents what they wanted in key policy areas and a different group what they expected to see from Mr. Putin, and documented a substantive difference between desires and expectations. More than half of respondents, for example, said they supported restoring relations with Western countries, but only 28% expected Mr. Putin to restore them. Some 58% expressed support for a truce with Ukraine, but only 29% expected Mr. Putin to agree to one. Quote, "We see that Russians want different things from what they expect from Mr. Putin," end quote, Mr. Minyayo said, continuing, "Probably if they did have any kind of alternative, they might make a different choice," end quote. Compelling alternative choices, however, have been all systematically eliminated for over a near quarter century.
Let us remain in the New York Times now for the national forecast. As a cold front finally clears South Florida and the East Coast, the risk of widespread severe thunderstorms will end today. Snow will continue near and along the Great Lakes, with enhanced snowfall expected for parts of the region and into the northeast as two cold fronts progress to the east. The Four Corners region will be another center of activity as a stall disturbance produces rain and snow showers. Much of the rest of the country will remain dry thanks to large areas of high pressure over the Gulf Coast and the Rockies. And now we pause for the local forecast.
Catch up on the editorial and opinion pages weekday mornings at 9:30 and Saturdays at 11 a.m. on Chris.
The forecast for tonight is mostly cloudy, with a low around 33. Tomorrow, Wednesday, there's a chance of rain, partly sunny, with a high near 53. Chance of precipitation is 30%. And tomorrow night, a chance of rain, partly cloudy, with a low around 28. Chance of precipitation is 30%. Thursday will be sunny, with a high near 40. And Thursday night, mostly clear, with a low around 22. Friday will be sunny, with a high near 43. And Friday night, there's a chance of snow mixing with rain, mostly cloudy, with a low around 31. Chance of precipitation is 40%. Have a good evening. Thank you for listening to Chris.
Business news from the New York Times is featured now in this section of the front pages, and we'll start with this headline. Cities face cutbacks as commercial real estate prices tumble. This by Alan Rappaport. In San Francisco, a 20-story office tower that sold for $146 million a decade ago was listed in December for just $80 million. In Chicago, a 200,000-square-foot office building in the city's Claiborne Corridor that sold in 2004 for nearly $90 million was purchased last month for $20 million, a 78% markdown. And in Washington, a 12-story building that mixes office and retail space three blocks from the White House that sold for $100 million in 2018 recently went for just $36 million. Such steep discounts have become normal for office space across the United States as the pandemic trends of hybrid and remote work have persisted, hollowing out urban centers that were once bustling with workers. But the losses are hitting more than just commercial real estate investors. Cities are also starting to bear the brunt as municipal budgets that rely on taxes associated with valuable commercial property are now facing shortfalls and contemplating cutbacks as lower assessments of property values reduce tax bills. Quote, "They're being sold at massive discounts," unquote. Aaron Peskin, president of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, said of office buildings in his city, quoting again, "If you were the folks who bought at the top of the market, you're taking a huge haircut," unquote. Mr. Peskin said that San Francisco's $14 billion budget is facing the prospect of a $1 billion shortfall over the next few years, in part because of lost commercial real estate tax revenue. Quote, "In the short term, it means less money in municipal coffers and a less robust downtown," unquote, he said. Since the pandemic, cities across the country have benefited from an economic rebound and an infusion of billions of dollars in federal relief money that was dispersed through the American Rescue Plan of 2021. That left municipalities so flush with cash that they were giving city workers raises, refurbishing local basketball and tennis courts, and upgrading sewage systems. But now budgets are starting to tighten. A fiscal report published by the National League of Cities last year found that optimism among municipal finance officials has started to wane amid concerns of weaker sales and lower property taxes coinciding with the expiration of federal funds. Cutbacks could lead to what Arpit Gupta, a professor at New York University's Stern School of Business, has described as an urban doom loop across the United States.
Are athletes truly employees? NCAA ideal faces big tests. This by Billy Witz. Robert McRae III has seen a lot. His grandmother, a civil rights activist in Los Angeles, often brought him along to rallies she organized and picket lines she walked, even to a gay pride parade with a giant anatomical balloon that he recalls with a smile might not have been age appropriate. As a Dartmouth College basketball player, he has played in NBA arenas and iconic venues like Duke's Cameron Indoor Stadium and Philadelphia's Palestra. Earlier this month, though, McRae's eyes got even wider. Photographers snapped pictures of him and his teammates as they walked together to cast votes to become the first college athletes to unionize. Hours later, after his team's final game of the season, he was surrounded by a small group of reporters who posed questions about labor and employment. Quote, "It has a little wow to it," end quote, McRae said of the attention. The unionization vote is only the start of a high-stakes battle that is playing out on both coasts as some of the most consequential challenges to college sports' amateur model take place in an unusual venue. The National Labor Relations Board, the federal agency that has jurisdiction over private employers. Dartmouth has signaled it will be digging in to fight the ruling that its men's basketball players be recognized as employees. Quote, "Even if we have to go to court to do so," end quote, a school spokesman said in an email. The college has recently hired the same law firm that is representing USC, as well as SpaceX, Trader Joe's, and Amazon, which have argued that the board is unconstitutional.
Next, from the business section of the New York Times, VW workers seek union vote at Tennessee plant for third time. The United Auto Workers said a supermajority of the 4,000 eligible workers at a Volkswagen factory had signed cards backing the union. This by Neil E. Boudet. Volkswagen employees in Tennessee who are hoping to join the United Auto Workers asked a federal agency on Monday to hold an election, a key step toward the union's longtime goal of organizing non-union factories across the South. The union said Volkswagen workers had filed a petition with the National Labor Relations Board asking for a unionization vote after a supermajority of the 4,000 eligible workers at the plant had signed cards supporting the UAW. It did not specify how many workers had signed cards, but it previously advised workers to get the support of more than 70% of hourly workers and establish a robust organizing committee before seeking an election. A simple majority vote is needed to win representation. Quote, "Today we are one step closer to making a good job at Volkswagen into a great career," unquote, Isaac Meadows, an assembly worker at the plant, said in a statement issued by the union. An election at the factory would be the first test of the UAW's strength after the union staged a wave of strikes in the fall against the three Detroit automakers, General Motors, Ford Motor, and Stellantis, and winning record wage increases with encouragement from the Biden administration. In a statement on Monday, Volkswagen said that it would, quote, "fully support," unquote, an election giving every employee a chance to vote on union representation. Quoting again, "We respect our workers' rights to a democratic process and to determine who should represent their interests," unquote, the company said.
In latest AI war escalation, Elon Musk releases chatbot code, this by Kate Conger and Kate Metz. Elon Musk released the raw computer code behind his version of the artificial intelligence chatbot on Sunday, an escalation by one of the world's richest men in a battle to control the future of AI. Grok, which is designed to give snarky replies, styled after the science fiction novel, quote, "The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy," end quote, is a product from xAI, the company Mr. Musk founded last year. While xAI is an independent entity from X, its technology has been integrated into the social media platform and is trained on users' posts. Users who subscribe to X's premium features can ask Grok questions and receive responses. By opening the code up for everyone to view and use, known as open sourcing, Mr. Musk waded further into a heated debate in the AI world over whether doing so could help make the technology safer or simply open it up to misuse. Quote, Still work to do, but this platform is already by far the most transparent and truth-seeking, end quote. Mr. Musk posted on Sunday in response to a comment on opening SourceX's recommendation algorithm. The move to open source chat box code is the latest volley between Mr. Musk and ChatGPT's creator, OpenAI, which the Mercurial billionaire sued recently over breaking its promise to do the same. Mr. Musk, who was a founder and helped OpenAI before thwarting several years later, has argued such an important technology should not be controlled solely by tech giants. And we'll be back after this message.
Hi, I'm Rick Gray, a Chris Radio volunteer. Chris wants you to know that the Connecticut Collaborative to End Loneliness is hosting a series of Connecting Connecticut conversations during March and April. Come by yourself or bring a friend or family member and join in the conversation on the importance of social health and the negative health aspects of loneliness. You'll hear from a panel of residents and experts, and then have the opportunity to share your thoughts. Here's the schedule for the Connecting Connecticut Conversation Series, sponsored in part by WellSpark Health. March 22nd, 2:30 to 4 p.m. at Southern Connecticut State University in New Haven. April 10th, 4:30 to 6 p.m. at the Danbury Public Library. April 24th, 3:30 to 5 p.m. at Trumbull's Main Library. Pick the time and location that works best for you, and you'll leave inspired to improve your social health. Attendance is limited, so go to their website, endlonelinessct.org, to register. That's endlonelinessct.org.
For the remainder of today's front pages, we'll be reading articles from the Hartford Current. And we'll start on the front page with the headline, Not the Image That We Want, Graffiti Latest Woe for High-Rise Office Tower Near I-84, this by Kenneth R. Goslin. The 15-story office tower rising above Sigourney Street in Hartford drew attention in the early 2000s when it was studied as a potential sick building, after state workers complained of coughing, asthma, and other health problems associated with allergies to mold and bad indoor air. Now the structure, hugging a prominent bend along Interstate 84, is again in the limelight for another dubious reason, graffiti. In recent weeks, graffiti appeared along the roof line of 25 Sigourney Street and has started to slowly descend along on different sides of the 1980s building. Hartford Mayor Arunan Arulampalam said Monday that he has seen the graffiti and has fielded complaints about it. Quote, "It's not the image we want in the city," unquote, Arulampalam said. Quoting again, "We strongly encourage folks to create art in designated art spaces. We have a graffiti area in Heavensgate Park, but we ask people to respect the city and respect the neighbors and respect private property," unquote. Arulampalam said the graffiti on the Sigourney Street building is a high-profile example of what happens when a building is left, quote, "vacant and unsecured for a number of years," unquote. It was not immediately clear Monday if 25 Sigourney Street has been cited by the city for blight violations. The building's owner, Florida businessman Casey Askar, did not immediately return a call seeking comment Monday. Askar purchased the building in 2020. The real estate investor who holds the commercial note on the property said Monday that Askar and an associated partnership, ASWH LLC, defaulted on a $1 million loan repayment in February of 2023. Quote, "Despite the plans to develop the property into commercial office space, Mr. Askar and ASWH appear to have abandoned the property entirely," unquote, William H. Coons III, the real estate investor, said in a statement. Quote, "The building has had reports of fires, vandalism, and the entire top floor is covered with graffiti that is plainly visible from the highway," unquote. "The building also is in litigation in both Connecticut and Florida," Coons said. Kuhn said that he wants to resolve the court dispute and possibly reclaim, quote, the Sigourney Street property so it can be rehabilitated into a commercial property that will provide valuable jobs and services to the city and people of Hartford, unquote. There were high hopes for the office tower at Sigourney Street and Capitol Avenue when it opened as the Xerox Center in the late 1980s. But the building never attracted big corporate leases to the city, as boom times soon went bust. The office tower passed off the city tax rolls in 1994 after it was bought by the state for offices. The state spent $6 million to seal the brick building, replace the roof, and remove wallboard and carpet damaged by leaking water. In 2004, the building was declared clean and watertight. Eventually, state workers were relocated and the building sat empty for more than 2 years overlooking I-84. In 2020, the state sold the structure for $1 million and ASGAR took a controlling stake. ASGAR planned to launch a renovation with $5 million of his own funds to ramp up improvements to start attracting potential tenants. ASGAR boldly predicted that the project would reach $30 million. City officials also saw the building, now in a no-man's land of confusing streets along the I-84 viaduct, potentially emerging as a way of connecting the Frog Hollow and Parkville neighborhoods.
State views non-binary gender option. Legislators see House bill as going down the rabbit hole or respect. By Allison Cross. Connecticut could be considering how to add non-binary as an option for gender on all state forms and applications if a new bill passes. House Bill 5314, which passed out of committee on Friday, would require each state agency to evaluate how it might update all digital or physical forms and applications to offer a non-binary option when individuals are asked to identify their sex or gender. The bill now heads to the House floor for consideration. About 1.2 million people in the United States identify as non-binary, according to the Williams Institute on Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity Law and Public Policy at the University of California, Los Angeles. Under the bill's current language, agencies must determine what changes are necessary and what resources such revisions would require. Each agency must complete its evaluation by January 1, 2026, for the Secretary of the Office of Policy and Management to issue a final report by February 15. Quote, it doesn't require that the forms be updated yet, end quote, Committee Chair Senator May Flexer said. Quote, it requires that the agencies figure out how to update them and make that evaluation as to how that would occur, end quote. The proposal was met with criticism from several Republican members of the board who expressed hesitancy in going down the rabbit hole or slippery slope of recognizing more than two genders. Quote, I don't think we should be updating the forms to have another gender on there, end quote, Ranking Member Representative Gail Mastrofrancesco said. Quote, it's male or female. I mean, how many genders are we going to start putting on the forms, end quote. Ranking Member Senator Rob Sampson said that during a debate on a similar proposal in a previous session, he suggested that the state offer an other category as a third option for gender. Quote, that might encompass anyone that doesn't fall into the two main categories based on their own interpretation, and that was not approved by the committee, end quote, Sampson said. Sampson raised concerns that a non-binary gender option could, quote, undermine the ability of law enforcement to do their job, end quote, in a scenario where police might be looking for a suspect who has changed their gender identity.
We remain on the front page of today's Current for this headline, Broker from Avon in Trump's Legal Drama. Giulietti appears in latest chapter of seeking $464 million bond, this by Edmund H. Mahoney. When former President Donald Trump told a New York court Monday that posting a $464 million bond was a, quote, practical impossibility, unquote, he was relying on the advice of Avon insurance broker Gary Giulietti, president of the Lockton Companies, the world's largest privately held insurance brokerage. An affidavit by Giulietti recounting his ultimately unsuccessful effort to satisfy the bond by, quote, scouring the market, unquote, and spending countless hours in talks with one of the world's biggest insurance companies is at the center of Trump's latest legal attempt to have the appeal bond lifted. Quote, based on my more than 50 years in the insurance industry, as well as my actual experience over the past several weeks during which I have been in contact with some of the largest insurance carriers in the world in an effort to try to obtain a bond for defendants, it is my opinion that obtaining an appeal bond for $464 billion is not possible under the circumstances presented, unquote, Giulietti wrote in the affidavit. For a variety of reasons, including internal policies, he said major global bond underwriters such as XL, The Hartford, and Travelers won't accept real estate as collateral. Many will only issue a single bond up to $100 million. For those and other reasons, Giulietti said Trump could be required to produce $1 billion to collateralize the bond and associated costs while maintaining sufficient cash on hand to run his businesses. Quote, while it is my understanding that the Trump Organization is in a strong liquidity position, it does not have $1 billion in cash or cash equivalents, unquote, Giulietti said. Giulietti could not be reached at his Avon office and did not respond to an email invitation to discuss the Trump case.
Ex-cop charged in ninth burglary, suspected in a string of incidents at more than 40 businesses. This by Justin Musinski. A former Glastonbury police officer has now been charged in 9 burglaries across the state after being charged earlier this month in a restaurant burglary in South Windsor. Patrick Hemingway, 37, was charged on March 8th with a third-degree burglary and third-degree criminal mischief in connection with a break-in last spring at the Mill on the River restaurant in Ellington Road, according to the South Windsor Police Department. Police accused Hemingway of breaking into the building on April 24, 2023, damaging an exterior door and a door to a safe he was unable to get into. Following his arrest, Hemingway appeared in Manchester Superior Court, where a judge set bail in the case at $100,000. He is due back in court on April 2nd. According to the State Department of Correction, Hemingway is now being held on bonds totaling just under $1.4 million. Court records show he has 9 burglary cases pending and a 10th arrest in which he's been accused of misusing a law enforcement database when he was an officer with the Glastonbury Police Department. Police departments in Wethersfield, Stratford, Shelton, Old Saybrook, East Hampton, and Manchester have filed burglary charges against the former officer, records show. According to the arrest warrant affidavit in multiple cases, Hemingway is a suspect in a burglary spree involving more than 40 businesses in Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts. He was first arrested last September in New Jersey and charged as a fugitive. The former cop was extradited to Connecticut on September 28, 2023, and was charged by Connecticut State Police with first-degree computer crimes and making a false statement. The arrest warrant affidavit collected by state police said Hemingway used his access to Collect, a database used by police officers and others in criminal justice that provide access to state and federal law enforcement resources, to determine if any agencies had identified him as a suspect while he was still working as a Glastonbury officer.
New Haven plans red light cameras is our next headline, this by Ed Stannard. The message in a Connecticut city is clear. A red light means to stop. And New Haven could become the first city to install cameras to catch those who drive through red lights, according to a proposal Mayor Justin Elliker announced Monday. Elliker made the announcement at a busy intersection, one block from where 3 people died after being hit by people driving through red lights in recent years. A driver sped through a red light behind him as he spoke. Quote, "This intersection is one of the most dangerous in our city. We've had 13 crashes just in 2023, unquote, Elliker said of South Frontage Road and Park Street, where he held his press briefing. That intersection, like the 10 others where the cameras will be installed, has had at least two crashes in the last 3 years caused by drivers going through red lights. That is the minimum criterion to install a camera, according to Sandeep Isola, director of the city's Department of Transportation, Traffic, and Parking. Quote, "My message to people out there is, if you run a red light, if you speed, you will get caught," unquote, Aliker said. Quoting again, "We will do everything possible to ensure that our streets are safe for everyone, whether you're a driver, a cyclist, or a pedestrian, because over the years we've lost far too many people to dangerous driving," unquote. He said there were 21 fatalities in 2020, 19 in 2021, 16 in 2022, and 11 in 2023, and two so far in 2024. Quote, "And while those numbers are going down, no fatality is acceptable," unquote, Aliker said. And the front pages will continue, but first, we pause for this message.
Windsor's Connecticut Valley Tobacco Museum, with the help of the Windsor Lions Club and Chris Radio, has set up 18 Chris Access readers describing various exhibits for low vision and print-disabled individuals. With input from the low vision population and working with a teacher of low vision and print-disabled individuals, we have also improved the accessibility of these readers with highly visible markers on the floor. To access the QR code, just open the camera option on your phone, scan the QR code, and press Enter once the link is shown. Please be aware that cell phone coverage in Northwest Park, where the Tobacco Museum is located, is limited, so please stop by the archive building to get the Wi-Fi password. If you or someone you know are interested in using this unique feature, please call the Tobacco Museum at 860-285-1888 or email windsorconnecticutmuseum@gmail.com. The Connecticut Valley Tobacco Museum is located in Windsor's Northwest Park, 135 Lang Road, and is open Fridays and Saturdays, noon to 4 p.m. through the last week of October.
On now to the Connecticut section of today's Hartford Current, and the lead headline at the top of the page reads, Police: Road rage led to fatal crash. Drivers allegedly chased each other before motorcyclist was crushed to death in Vernon. This by Taylor Hartz. A police investigation found that a driver of a motorcycle and the driver of a reportedly stolen car were allegedly chasing each other in a Connecticut road rage incident that led to a motorcyclist being crushed between two cars and killed. Police believe that the fatal crash, which happened in Vernon in late February, was the result of intentional actions and have charged a Hartford man with first-degree manslaughter, according to an arrest warrant affidavit. Investigators allege that Jamarcus McCatty was speeding and driving up behind the motorcyclist when the allegedly stolen Infiniti Q50 he was driving struck the motorcycle and crushed it between his car and a Kia. McCatty then allegedly struck another vehicle, a parked Subaru that a woman and her mother were sitting in while waiting for the granddaughter's school bus to arrive, sending it careening down the road, according to the Vernon Police Department. McCatty allegedly fled from the scene as the driver of the motorcycle, 25-year-old James Faulkner of Vernon, laid unresponsive in the road, according to the arrest warrant affidavit. Investigators believe Faulkner's motorcycle was crushed between the Infiniti and the Kia, then slid on its right side against the road before flipping over on its left side, police said. Data downloaded from the Infiniti showed that McCatty was allegedly speeding, pressed 100% on the accelerator, and did not attempt to brake as he struck Faulkner's Harley-Davidson, police wrote in the affidavit warrant. Quote, "I believe probable cause exists to believe that the crash was not an accident, but an intentional collision," unquote, lead investigator Officer Matthew Guillemette wrote in the arrest warrant for McCatty that was signed on March 12th. The warrant affidavit provided details of the fatal crash, including eyewitness accounts and descriptions of multiple surveillance videos that showed the lead-up to the crash and footage of McCaddy running through the town and the woods after striking the vehicles, police said.
A long time coming. In East Hartford, demolition begins on blighted Silver Lane Plaza. This by Don Stakem. After more than a decade of trying to get rid of the blighted Silver Lane Plaza, East Hartford made high-powered progress Monday morning when a Manafort Brothers excavator ripped down the portico outside the vacant Gemart grocery store. Heavy equipment over the next few weeks will tear down the entire center building at the dilapidated plaza, the end of the line for what was once East Hartford's thriving retail hub. Town officials have long envisioned a redevelopment for the 22-acre site and looking for Massachusetts-based Grossman Development Group to produce details for its proposed mix of modular homes along with new restaurants and retail. Quote, "This has been a long time coming. It's an incredibly happy day when we can take down the biggest eyesore in the community," end quote, Town Council Chair Richard Kehoe said as a small group of local politicians and business leaders gathered to watch the ceremonial start of demolition. Mayor Connor Martin climbed onto Manafort's large Volvo 380 excavator to pose for photos, then led the cheers when the machine tore down the portico just a few minutes later. East Hartford is still negotiating to move the final four tenants out of the plaza's two smaller buildings, and then will demolish those structures too. That will leave a clear field for Grossman to build on and will be the second major phase of a cleanup in a part of town that's been run down for years. Just to the northeast of the plaza is the vacant Showcase Cinema site where Josco Development and Zellman Real Estate are soon to break ground on the Concourse Park market rate apartment complex, East Hartford's largest single residential expansion in decades. Quote, "Both of these properties, Silver Lane Plaza and Showcase Cinemas, represent the rebuilding and revitalization of a vital neighborhood and commercial corridor here in East Hartford," end quote, Martin said in a brief speech. Quote, "Concourse Park will be home to around 400 amenity-rich apartments, and this site that we're on right now will be mixed use with commercial, retail, and housing," end quote, Martin said, adding that his administration is asking Grossman to factor in a bigger share of retail, restaurants, entertainment venues than it initially proposed.
Pharmacy giant to lay off hundreds in state. Walgreens closing Killingley Distribution Center. This by Kenneth R. Goslin. Pharmacy giant Walgreens Company will close a distribution center in Killingley later this year, laying off hundreds of employees, according to a notice filed with the State Labor Department. Walgreens will lay off 322 employees at the distribution center in the Dayville section beginning in May of 2024, on the 17th of that month, according to a WARN notice filed with the state on March 14th. The Killingley Distribution Center is one of two being eliminated in the United States, as the drugstore chain said it seeks to, quote, "streamline capabilities to best support our stores," unquote, a Walgreens spokesman said in a statement. The other distribution center being shuttered is in Orlando, Florida. A total of 646 jobs are being eliminated, according to the statement. Quote, "We are focused on aligning our operational structure to best serve our patients and customers," unquote, the statement said. Walgreens has about 100 locations in Connecticut. Walgreens couldn't immediately provide a count of employees. Walgreens said the layoffs are expected to be permanent. The pharmacy chain said employees losing their jobs will be given the chance to participate in the on-site career fairs and outplacement services to help find new employment. Workers losing their jobs also can apply for other open positions with the company.
Coffee, sweet treats, and cuddles. Marcy's Angels, a new cat cafe aimed at getting pets in need adopted, is coming to Glastonbury. This by Sean Krofsik, special to The Current. When Beth Drazak visited New Haven's Mew Haven Cat Cafe last year and spoke with business owner Angela Pulo, Drazak told her if she ever won the lottery, she would open up her own cat cafe. The 54-year-old Glastonbury resident hasn't won the jackpot yet, but she's getting her wish of opening up a cat cafe. Marcy's Angels Cat Cafe is planning to open sometime in midsummer at 3039 Main Street in Glastonbury and will be the third known cat cafe open in the state. For Drazak, it all started with the visit to New Haven last March. Quote, "She told me I didn't have to win the lottery. I couldn't get it out of my head. Angela has been a great mentor for me," end quote, Drazak said. Quote, "We are getting permits and having inspections and waiting to see what this renovation budget will be. But I will do what I have to do to get this open," end quote. She said this is a, quote, "pre-retirement passion project," end quote. She also works in Glastonbury as an administrative assistant for a financial advisor, a post she has held for 24 years. Drazak named the cafe after the first cat she owned as an adult after being around cats her entire life. Quote, "Marcy was adopted in 1995 and was lucky to have had 11 amazing years with her," end quote, Drazak noted on her cafe website. Quote, "This will give people a chance to visit with cats for a potential adoption. That's a good thing," end quote, Glastonbury town planner Gary Haynes said. Quote, "It's something unique that we don't have in the area," end quote. The cafe will be a for-profit business, but her passion for cats and getting adoption done for of cats in need, Drazak said. The cafe will house as many as 10 cats that are up for adoption. All cats will come from East Hartford's Protectors of Animals, where Drazak is one of many volunteers. All of the cats will be fully vetted. They will be spayed or neutered, will have received appropriate shots, will have been socialized, and have gone through behavioral assessment, she said. The cafe will be on one side of the business, and the lounge and the cats will be on the other side. And the lottery for Monday, March 18th. Play 3 day, 1, 9, 2, wild ball, 0. Play 4 day, 7, 4, 8, 5, wild ball, 6. The late lotto numbers were not drawn in time for this edition. For results, please visit current.com, lottery. Sunday's late numbers. Play 3 night, 1-1-1, wild ball 1. Play 4 night, 9-7-0-2, wild ball 6. Cash 5, 5-14-19-20-34. Lucky for life, 1-15-20-43-44. Lucky ball 4. Tonight's estimated lotto jackpot, $1.9 million. Tonight's estimated Mega Millions jackpot, $875 million.
And now for today in history. We'll start by noting that today is Tuesday. This is March 19th, the 79th day of 2024. There are 287 days left in the year. And this, of course, is the last full day of winter, at least until December. Today's highlight in history occurred on March 19th of 1995. After a 21-month hiatus, Michael Jordan returned to professional basketball with his former team, the Chicago Bulls. He would go on to win 3 more NBA championships to go with the 3 he had with the Bulls before. Also on this date, in 1859, the opera Faust by Charles Gounod premiered in Paris. In 1931, Nevada Governor Fred B. Balzar signed a measure legalizing casino gambling in the state. In 1942, during World War II, President Franklin D. Roosevelt ordered men between the ages of 45 and 64 inclusive to register for non-military duty. In 1945, during World War II, 724 people were killed when a Japanese dive bomber attacked the carrier USS Franklin off Japan. The ship was saved. In 1977, the series finale of Mary Tyler Moore aired on CBS TV, ending the situation comedy's 7-season run. In 1987, televangelist Jim Baker resigned as chairman of his PTL ministry organization amid a sex and money scandal involving Jessica Hahn, a former church secretary. In 1991, on this date, Polish President Lech Walesa arrived in Washington for his first state visit to the United States. And in 2003, President George W. Bush ordered the start of war against Iraq. And that's all for this edition of the Front Pages. We've been reading from today's Hartford Current and New York Times. Your readers have been Kathy Danaher. I'm Jim McPherson. If you missed any part of the program, it is repeated this evening at 6 p.m. and 11 p.m., and it is available anytime on our telephone reader service and on demand at our website, chrisradio.org. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.